We have, over the past several weeks at the 11 o'clock hour, tried to encourage you to fit yourself with octifocal lens so that you might be able to look into the scriptures, develop a biblical worldview, and then learn how to engage the world around you so as to make an impact in that world around you. Certainly the list that we went through, 8 specifics, minimal specifics, was not comprehensive. But I hope that this morning to set the context for a concern that is upon my heart. The title of the message this morning, and I just want to open the line of thought up, is this: beer drinking, brethren, and sipping, sisters, is the title of the message this morning. Beer drinking, brethren, and sipping, sisters. And you might be taken back by that very narrow, at least apparently narrow, look into what some may consider to be a very obscure problem that afflicts but a handful of people. But I want to assure you that from all of the reading and the research and the observations of 35 years in ministry, that it is not an opportunity for a person like me or a church like ours to take the high ground as though we are immune from the various and sundry kinds of personal demons that people have to deal with, because it doesn't provide that high ground. But it is a situation now where it has apparently reached epidemic proportions within the church. And I say the church as a whole. The church as a whole. And if I don't say it, who will? If I don't address it, who would? And so I need to set that in a context in light of the subject matter that we have been talking about concerning a biblical worldview, and ask this question: how in the world do we ever get here? How in the world is the church descended into such a state where it openly and boastfully engages in lifestyle and practices that were absolutely thought of as renegade 25, 30 years ago? Let me give you a couple of examples, and then I want to start in laying the foundation. It is said that some members of Spirit Garage meet in an Irish bar in downtown Minneapolis on Wednesdays for a weekly theological pub, a mix of biblical discussion and beer. The Mars Hill Church in Seattle, Washington, sets up a champagne bar at their New Year's Eve parties, and attendees are reminded to bring their IDs so they can enjoy the bubbly. Mars Hill also has Sunday school classes teaching beer brewing lessons for the men of the church. Now, unless you think these are some off-the-wall cultic type churches, I want to reassure you that these are large, influential churches who are pastored by men who write a lot of books, who make a lot of transcontinental visits from place to place and spread their leaven. I want you also to remind you that as we are entering into the Christmas holiday season, that if you were to take and ask those who keep track of such statistics, what is the single, where does the Christmas, New Year's time of year rank among all of the holidays in America concerning the total consumption of alcohol? You would find that Christmas ranks number 9 or number 10 on that list. Super Bowl Sunday is probably the number one day for alcoholic consumption among Christian people. Riverview Community Church in Holt, Michigan has a river brew night featuring homebrewed beer and religious discussion. Ministry leader Brett Maxwell says it's intimidating for someone to walk into a church having never been there. But if a friend invites them to go and hang out and have a brew or two and hang out with some of the guys from the church, that's a much less intimidating environment. When asked what Jesus would drink, Maxwell replies, I quote, "I believe he would sit down with the people at the bar and he would drink what they were drinking and he would be happy to do that." Now, without going any further to tip the scale here, I want to have you take it a piece by piece, and I need to lay a reasonable foundation for what we are about to proceed upon. When you think about the ideas that we have tried to bring forth concerning the construction of a worldview, I'm led to believe, and I believe that I have mentioned this to the people on a different occasion, that the bulk of American Christians do not have a biblical worldview simply because they are not in possession of a well-structured belief system that is personally theirs by conviction. And the result of that is that there is a 2600 worldview leading to blurred vision at the best. John Stott wrote that, he says, as a result of modern communication, media, and ease of travel, many countries are increasingly pluralistic. And what people want is an easygoing syncretism, a truce in interreligious competition, a mishmash of the best from all religions. But we Christians cannot surrender either the finality or the uniqueness of Jesus Christ. There is simply nobody else like him. His incarnation, atonement, and resurrection have no parallels. In consequence, he is the one and only mediator between God and the human race. This exclusive affirmation is strongly, even bitterly resented. It is regarded by many as intolerably intolerant. And so we have then the continued mutation of what we have long since discovered to be termed ecumenism, where there is a fusion of two or more diverse belief systems, an attempt to reconcile the irreconcilable by mutual reduction of core doctrines to the lowest commonly shared doctrinal denominator. When we think about this, the scriptures are fairly clear about it. While we're in the New Testament, look please in Ephesians chapter 5 and verse 11. Before we trace back to the Old Testament for a couple of readings there. In Ephesians chapter 5 and verse number 11, I think it is very clear and forthright what the apostolic instruction would be with regard to those who would try to fuse diverse and contrary doctrinal schemes. The 11th verse says, "Have no fellowship with the unfruitful works of darkness, but rather reprove them." It's a shame to speak, to speak of those things which are done of them in secret. And then you go back to the Old Testament. Would you find your way to the book of 1 Kings? 1 Kings, please. And the 11th chapter, verse number 33. Chapter 11, and verse number 33. A statement, again, after the appointment of Jeroboam to rule the 10 tribes of Israel. And verse 33, the statement here is that because they have forsaken me, and you might underline or circle these words, and, because they have forsaken me and have worshipped Ashtaroth, the goddess of the Zidonians, Chemosh, the god of the Moabites, and Milcom, the god of the children of Ammon, and have not walked in my ways to do that which is right in my eyes, to keep my statutes and my judgments as did David his father. It is that we go from the worshiping of an assortment of gods, the pluralistic nature of worship, where it doesn't make any difference, at least in the pagan mindset, whether it is the god of this nation or the god of this nation or the god of this nation. We'll take the best of all of them and run them all together. That takes us to the 18th chapter, where there is in the 21st verse this famous question that's asked by the prophet, where the where Ahab and the people of Israel were all gathered at Mount Carmel. Elijah came to all the people and he said, "How long halt ye between two opinions?" Between two opinions. If the Lord be God, follow him. But if Baal, then follow him. But one thing you can't do, it's clear from Elijah's statement, is you can't follow both of them simultaneously and please either one of them. And all the more compounded is the fact that the one God does not exist except as a figment of the imagination of people's minds. But the principle is well stated. You cannot possibly serve this one and this one simultaneously or syncretically. There's no taking the best of this one and the best of this one and merging them together. And then you come to the to 2 Kings chapter 17. 2 Kings 17, verse 28. If you read through the 17th chapter here, verses 28 to 33, you get the gist of an attempt made to essentially hire priests or teachers to teach the people how best to syncretically worship while in the land. If you look beginning at that verse 28, then one of the priests whom they carried away from Samaria came and dwelt in Bethel and taught them how they should fear the Lord. Howbeit, verse 29, every nation made gods of their own, put them in the houses of the high places which the Samaritans had made, every nation in their cities where they dwelt. Now if you read down further, there seems to be in verses 32 and verse 33 a combination or an attempt to combine the fear of the Lord with the worship of pagan gods. And verse 34 says, "Unto this day they do after their former manners, they fear not the Lord, neither do they after their statutes." And again, the admonition in verse 35, "You shall not fear other gods, nor bow yourselves to them, nor serve them, nor sacrifice to them." But there were some who would perhaps take a part of that advice and say, "Look, I do want to fear the Lord, but I don't see anything wrong with making concessions to or accommodating the gods of the land." Now that may be a crude way of saying what was the mindset of the ancient world, but it is just as much clear today that that's what goes on in the Western world in which we live. And I want to get to it shortly as to why that happens. Then you come to the book of Zephaniah chapter 1, the fourth book from the end of the Old Testament. Zephaniah chapter 1. Just a sample of syncretic religion or nutshell ecumenism. Verse number 4, drop the verse 5. about them that worship the host of heaven upon the housetops, and them that worship and that swear by the Lord, and that swear by Malcolm. So you see in verse number 5, there is again a situation going in the nation of Israel where there was an attempt at syncretic religion, a crude ecumenism for this, for that generation. And I would remind you again what Paul said to the Ephesians, have no fellowship with them. Now, what I want to do at this point is take you to a place where you might be able to grasp something that eluded me for a long time and was the cause of no amount of small frustration to me personally. I thought that I had a good grasp of the times in which we lived, but it became apparent to me that I did not. And as a result of my miscalculations and a misunderstanding, I attempted to do things that I thought would be a help and a blessing and encouragement. And I finally had to come to the place and just wave the white flag and realize that it is a predictable difficulty to live in an age and the age in which we now live when truth does not matter and the Word of God even matters less. And how do we get there? In the Old Testament book of 1 Chronicles 12 and 32, it speaks about men that had understanding of the times and that then that they should know what Israel ought to do. And I look at that verse and I say, ought not the church be equipped with the same kind of men who have understanding of the times? A biblical worldview will enable us to understand the view of the world as regards truth or its current irrelevance. You know, the Church of Jesus Christ does serve as the pillar and ground of truth. And we must learn that the Western world in which we now live has changed philosophically, changed. And by that I mean, and let me just take this bit by bit and not overwhelm you or choke you with it. Words do not mean, they do not necessarily mean what they say. In our generation, clashing logic is the acceptable norm, but words do not necessarily mean what they say in print. For example, think about business contracts that corporations enter into or individuals with corporations enter into. Although I realize that lawyers have to make a living, there seems to be some kind of a mannerism in which every contract is written is always written with some kind of a hidden loophole. So that if one party or the other decides that it's really not profitable for them, they can just walk, no matter what their word was. And there's no court in the land that will usually uphold the contract based on the loophole. And then you think about marriage vows. Marriage vows. Now just put aside the world's situation and think with me about the local church. About Christianity as a composite family. And understand the tragedy that the divorce rate in the Christian community is at a worse level than even in the secular world. It is now, it used to be lamentably put forth that one out of every two ended in separation or divorce, and now it has even gone below that. And then think about church covenant, the words in your church covenant. Do those words mean anything to you? Do the words of the church covenant mean anything to you at all? And then think about all the political promises that were made. And I don't even want to go into that. I mean, I could spend all day jumping around up on that. I'm not going to even go there. You do your own jumping. But we live in a time when clashing logic is the accepted norm. And I read this excerpt to the folks way back when we had this in Sunday school class. And even every time I read it, I just, all the air just leaves me. He said, Pastor Gilly wrote of one of his pastoral critics. And by the way, Pastor Gary Gilly's a renowned author and a respected man of God. Last I understood, he was leading a church in Texas, Houston, Texas, somewhere in there. But he wrote of one of his friends who was a critic, who challenged his assertion of the church's truth mandate as found in 1 Timothy chapter 3:15. And the critic said this, now listen carefully. The Bible does not place a priority on being right. We are to be holy. We are to be righteous. We are to be pure. We are to be just. We are to believe. We are to understand. And we are to proclaim the truth. But that's not the same as being right, said the critic. And I sit back and I think about that, and I'm saying to myself, what in the world is that guy thinking about? How does he come to that kind of conclusion? How does he get there? How can he be so right in his assertion and yet flip it up on its head and deny the very premise that underlies? How does that happen? Well, it's the generation in which we live. And so, let's understand our times. There are three time eras that I want to share with those of you who've never heard it before. For those of you who have, bide your time. A review is always good for the soul. And maybe you'll find, like me, that you have forgotten most of everything else that you heard, and because I've generally forgotten most everything else I've said myself sometimes. But there are three basic time eras that we need to grasp hold of. Number one, we'll label it the pre-modern time warp, the modern time warp, and the post-modern time warp. Arbitrarily, they fit into a chronological niche. We will arbitrarily designate the medieval days up until about the late 1700s for the pre-modern era. And during that time, please now get hold of these three time warps. In that time era, no one disputed the supernatural. No one. It was generally accepted norm. No one even disputed God's existence. There was an inclination of the people in that generation that conceded the existence of spirit beings and gods, small g, of a minor sort. Beyond the realm of the human physical senses, there was the spiritual world. Nobody had to be convinced of that. And with this overarching presupposition, there were multiple worldviews that were existent at the time, each competing with one another. Christianity among them, classical Greek philosophy another one, mythology, animism. So in that time warp, the challenge to the Bible-believing community in that day was to consider the truth mandate. The challenge was this. The church, in their message to the people in their culture, was that there is only one true God. Their message was dominated by sola Christos, Christ alone, only Christ. The very premise of the supernatural, the very notion of existence of God, was never in dispute. But what was complicating the issue in those days was that with all these worldviews floating around there, everybody had their notion of a God. Now, we go from the pre-modern time, and by the way, we don't live there anymore. You're living in a time warp where people do not accept out of hand the supernatural. You are living in a time warp now where people question the existence of God. And if there's to be admission of God at any point, it is that man climbs upward and eventually becomes a god, if anything at all. The second philosophical wind that blew through the world shifted to modernism. At or about the conclusion of the revolution in France in the late 80s, the fall of the Bastille, it is sometimes seen in our history books as the age of enlightenment or the age of human reason. And in that particular time, the revolutionaries of the day made Christianity irrelevant. Just irrelevant. And the shift in worldview occurred when that wind blew through. There were three basic authority structures that were established. Three authority structures. Number one, there was the establishment church, Romanism, under the leadership of the Pope of Rome. Number two, there were the rebels to that movement. There was the Protestant movement and the reformers, and their leader was Christ Jesus, sola Christos. And the third authority structure that was in place, co-equal with the other two in that generation, was Islam, with Muhammad and the Quran playing a role in different parts of the world. Now, those three authority structures, the philosophers of the day challenged those authority structures and the dogma that issued from them. And so the Enlightenment proponents sought to liberate mankind from religious superstition and ancient myths. And for human reason, can only be validated through scientific, empirical evidence. Look, if you can't prove something under a microscope, it isn't so. And so when you bring up the subject of faith, you can't put faith under a microscope. And so unless you have that empirical evidence, there is no reason to think that your ideas can be validated. And only through these mechanisms could truth be discerned. Man, you see, now in this age had become the arbiter of what is absolute truth. Now I want to say to you that even though we do not live in the modernism era, some tendencies of the modernistic thought still contaminate the church. Back in those days, men became the arbiter of what is truth. They would pick up Bible, if they were to pick up a Bible at all, and they would cherry pick texts out of Scripture and assign to them the relative degrees of truth, or dismiss certain passages otherwise. You say, well, what do you mean by that? Well, you take, for example, the whole thing we talked about in Sunday school this morning, the prophecy of the virgin in Isaiah 7 and verse 14. You take the whole notion of the fall of man in Genesis chapter 3. You take the whole remedy in Matthew chapter 28 on the Great Commission. You think about the impact upon the Bible-believing Christian in Hebrews chapter 10 and verse number 25. And in each of those areas, Hebrews chapter number 13, 1 Timothy chapter number 3, you take those portions of Scripture and men then become the arbiter of what is true. And they dogmatically resisted the authoritative ministry of the teacher and the pastor and the missionary across that culture. Even as they do today in some places. Some still inclined to be religious and syncretically enlightened conceded the existence of God, but they copped a different view of God. They said this, we don't deny that God exists, and we're talking now about those in the modern era. We don't deny that God exists, but you know what we do deny? We don't think He's interested in the creation anymore. We think that God just created the world and walked away from it, completely detached from it, leaving us, man, to decide what's right and wrong and do as we please. The deist. Life would be good, upward, forward, progress inevitable, and finally arriving at societal utopia, finally arriving at a place where man could be happy, happy, happy. Now, with the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989, that whole idea collapsed. It was apparent that human reason, scientific validation, progressive social experimentation would disappoint and disillusion. And yet, saying all this to set the context from which we shall enter in upon the mindset of the beer-drinking brothers and the sipping sisters, when we come to the third shift, we go from the modern to the postmodern. And we can see this clearly because it engulfs us. You remember that old line of reasoning that I've shared with you folks for years about the generational rot? What one generation will tolerate, the next generation carries to extreme. And now we see it a step further. What one generation tolerates, the next generation carries to extreme, and then the following generation takes it to a radical extreme, where we are heading now. So when we think about the postmodern worldview, each era had its view of the truth. In the pre-modern time, truth was found in revelation. In the modern time era, the truth was found in reason and science. In the postmodern world in which we now live, here, catch now, truth is rejected. Truth is rejected. Most people will live and die by the notion of Fletcherism. And Fletcherism is simply the concept that the end justifies the means at all times. The end justifies the means. Universal, absolute truth does not exist. The postmodern culture, the one in which we now live, the people that live around us will not acknowledge that there is any such thing as truth. Except that there is no truth. That is one thing they are absolutely rock solid certain about. That's the only absolute that they live by. There is no, absolutely no truth. How do you know that? Truth, you see, is a varied mental construction of the individual, not found in the ancient text or laboratory experimentation. And so predictably, truth morphs into whatever works. If my methods work, then it's good. It turns into pragmatism, then becomes a quasi-god. Truth morphs into whatever works. If I want to feel good, use what works. Now for me, that's a cheeseburger. I can get high on a cheeseburger. Just like some people can get high on crack. Or coke. Or alcohol. Or tobacco. Or how about those who OD on carbs? I have problems to solve, so I find what works. I don't use truth. Truth doesn't enter into the equation. What God has said, even less so. Whatever is appealing and attractive to me is what matters. Whatever I can do or acquire. And I conclude this morning with this truth. This observation, you know, before the towers were destroyed by the Islamist jihadists in September of 01, a survey, a Barna survey found that 38% of Americans at that time believed in the concept of absolute truth. 38%. Post 9/11 surveys have revealed 22% now believe in absolute truth. And yet 53% of Americans surveyed say religion is important to them. And of those questioned, 33% claim to be evangelical, gospel-believing Christians. Yet philosophical, theological erosion is worse now than it has ever been. And so the challenge to the church, our church, is this. We have to recognize that we are not dealing with either the pre-modern or the modern mindset. No longer is there an assumption of the supernatural within the worldview of this culture, any more than a dominant, yet perhaps residual worldview driven by human enlightenment or scientific conclusions, but rather a culture that debates the very existence of truth. So let me give you this little thing to think about. No one, none of those who would be called beer drinking brethren or sipping sisters would debate the point that drunkenness is sin. None of them. None of them who write on the subject, none of them who speak out on the subject would debate that drunkenness is sin. Here's the problem. The law defines drunkenness on a breathometer as 0.08. That's the legal definition of drunkenness. At a certain point, physical anatomical reactions altered. And I will say to you that that legal definition does not measure up to the Ephesians 5:18 sobriety test. And therein lies the problem. Therein is the problem. And there is exactly why we have an epidemic sweeping through Bible-believing churches today, where it is becoming more and more the normal accepted rationale that moderation in everything is desirable, including the consumption of alcoholic beverages. If Jesus would do it, why not me?